A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching those behind-the-scenes airline videos on YouTube, the ones where the crew arrives early and huddles for a briefing before a long-haul flight, and he wants to know what's actually happening in those rooms. How many people does it take to get a transatlantic flight off the ground? How far in advance does the preparation begin? And who are the invisible players making it all work? He called it the ordinary miracle, which is about right. So, let's pick a flight and walk through it.
Let's use BA-17-8. London Heathrow to New York JFK. Scheduled departure 11 a.m. Boeing 777-300ER. It's a real flight, it runs daily, and it's about as representative a transatlantic departure as you can find. And here's the number I want to start with. By the time you, the passenger, buckle your seatbelt and glance at the safety card, you are roughly the 200th person to have done something to get that aircraft moving. 200 people across something like 18 different job categories, and most of them never set foot on the aircraft. They're in operations centers, they're on the ramp, they're in catering kitchens miles away. The passenger sees the cabin crew and maybe a glimpse of the pilots, and that's it. But the preparation started days before the passenger even checked in.
The YouTube video of the crew briefing, that's basically the final scene of a movie that started shooting 72 hours earlier.
And the movie has three acts. The strategic phase, which runs from about 72 hours out to maybe 12 hours before departure. The tactical phase, from 12 hours to about 2 hours out. And then the execution phase, that final 90-minute turnaround at the gate. And what makes a transatlantic flight different from the domestic quick turn we talked about before isn't just the fuel load. It's that the entire preparation is built around redundancy and regulatory compliance rather than pure speed.
It's less like a pit stop and more like a military operation where the plan assumes three things will go wrong and has contingencies for all of them.
The contingencies are legally required. That's the key difference. A domestic flight can be a bit scrappy. A transatlantic flight cannot. Let's start with the strategic phase. 72 hours before BA-178 pushes back, the airline's network operations center, which is basically a room full of screens and people who look like they haven't slept since the invention of the jet engine, runs what's called a fleet assignment model.
Which sounds like a piece of software that decides which aircraft goes where.
It is, and it's solving what mathematicians call a combinatorial optimization problem. You've got a fleet of, say, 40 long-haul aircraft, and you've got dozens of routes, each with different demand patterns, different crew availability, different maintenance requirements. The software, and the big players here are Sabre and Jeppesen, runs overnight and spits out an assignment. This 777 will fly to JFK, that 777 will fly to Dubai, this A380 will go to Singapore. And it's not just picking which aircraft, it's also doing crew pairing, which is an even uglier problem.
Crew pairing meaning which pilots and which cabin crew are assigned, to which flights, taking into account duty time limits, rest requirements, training currency, all of that.
It's brutal. A pilot can't just be assigned to any flight. They need to be current on that specific aircraft type. They need to have done a certain number of landings in the last 90 days. They need to have had the legally mandated rest period, which for long haul is significantly longer than for short haul. And the software also has to account for the fact that the crew flying to New York today needs to be positioned to fly back tomorrow or the day after, and that return flight needs a crew too. So you're solving a puzzle that spans days and continents.
All of this is happening before the aircraft even knows it's going to JFK.
Now by the time we hit T-minus 12 hours, we enter the tactical phase. This is where the dispatcher takes over, and I want to spend some time on the dispatcher because it's the most underappreciated role in aviation.
The dispatcher being the person on the ground who shares legal responsibility for the flight.
Shares legal responsibility. This is one of those things most passengers don't know. Under FAI regulations and the equivalent European rules under EASA, the dispatcher and the captain are jointly responsible for the safety of the flight. The dispatcher prepares the flight plan. The captain reviews and signs it, and both of them have the authority to delay or cancel the flight. The dispatcher is not a secretary. The dispatcher is a co-author of the flight's entire operational profile.
When people say the pilot is in command, that's true. But they're in command of a plan that someone else wrote with them.
That plan is a document of astonishing detail. The dispatcher files it with NATS, which is the UK air traffic control provider, at least 2 hours before departure. And it has to include, at minimum, the route, the altitude profile, the fuel calculation, and 3 alternate airports.
That's one of those things that sounds excessive until you're over the North Atlantic and the weather closes in at your first alternate.
The alternates for a London to New York flight are typically Shannon in Ireland, Gander in Newfoundland, and Bangor in Maine. You'll notice those are spaced out. That's not random. They're positioned so that at any point along the route, you're within diversion range of at least one of them. And this is where ETOPS comes in.
Extended Range Twin Engine Operational Performance Standards. The rule that says a twin-engine aircraft has to be able to reach a diversion airport within a certain number of minutes on a single engine.
For a 777, it's typically ETOPS 180, 180 minutes, 3 hours on one engine, fully loaded, at a safe altitude. That requirement dictates which North Atlantic tracks the flight can use. The North Atlantic isn't like driving on a highway where the lanes are fixed. The tracks shift every day based on the jet stream. The dispatcher has to pick a track that keeps the aircraft within 180 minutes of a suitable airport at all times.
If the jet stream is particularly strong, pushing the track further north or south, you might lose Gander as a viable alternate and have to replan around Keflavik or somewhere in Greenland.
Now let's talk about the fuel calculation, because this is where the dispatcher earns their salary. The fuel load for BA-17-8 on a typical day is between 65 and 70 tons. That's roughly 80,000 liters. And at current jet fuel prices, that's around $40,000 per flight.
The fuel bill alone is a small mortgage.
The dispatcher has to account for 5 separate categories of fuel. Taxi fuel, which is what you burn getting from the gate to the runway. Trip fuel, which is the actual crossing. Contingency fuel, which is 5% of the trip fuel to cover unexpected headwinds or routing changes. Alternate fuel, which is what you need to get from JFK to your alternate if you can't land. And final reserve fuel, which is 30 minutes of holding at 1,500 feet above the alternate.
5 buckets. And if you get any of them wrong, you either don't have enough fuel or you're carrying too much, which means you're burning fuel to carry fuel.
Which brings us to the tankering decision. Tankering is when you carry extra fuel beyond what you need for the flight, because fuel at your destination is more expensive than fuel at your origin. JFK fuel prices are typically higher than Heathrow, so the dispatcher has to run a calculation. Is it cheaper to carry an extra 5 tons of fuel across the Atlantic, burning some of it just to carry itself, or to refuel at JFK for the return leg?
It's a trade war fought in kerosene.
The answer changes daily based on spot prices. Some airlines have dedicated fuel analysts whose entire job is to optimize this.
All right. So the dispatcher has filed the flight plan. The aircraft is assigned. The crew is assigned. When do the actual human beings show up?
The pilots arrive at the crew briefing center at T-minus 2 hours. And people sometimes wonder, why 2 hours? The flight itself is only 7 hours. Why do you need 2 hours of preparation?
I've wondered that. 2 hours of prep for a 7-hour flight seems disproportionate until you think about what they're actually doing.
What they're doing is building a mental model of every possible thing that could go wrong and what they'll do about it. They review the NOTAMs, which are Notices to Air Missions. These are bulletins about everything from a taxiway closure at Heathrow, to a navigation aid being out of service over the Atlantic, to construction equipment near the runway at JFK. A typical NOTAM package for a transatlantic flight can run to dozens of pages.
Most of which are irrelevant, but you have to read them all to find the one that matters.
The one that matters might be something like, the ILS approach for runway 22 left at JFK is out of service, which means you'll need to plan for a different type of approach which affects your fuel burn and your diversion planning. Then they review the weather. Not just the departure weather and the arrival weather, but the en route weather. The jet stream position, the turbulence forecast, any convective activity over the Atlantic. And then they review the flight plan the dispatcher filed. They're not just rubber stamping it, they're checking every assumption.
The captain, in particular, is doing something the industry calls the IROPS mental checklist. What if the aircraft goes technical at the last minute? What if the slot is delayed and we miss our arrival window at JFK? What if a passenger has a medical emergency, and we have to divert to Gander?
The captain has to be ready to make those calls without hesitation. That's why the 2 hours exists. It's not about paperwork. It's about building situational awareness. Meanwhile, the cabin crew has their own briefing. The purser, who's the lead flight attendant, arrives at T-minus 1.5 hours and conducts a safety briefing that's specific to the aircraft type.
Specific to the type, meaning a 777 briefing is different from an A380 briefing.
The door operation is different. The evacuation procedures are different. The location of emergency equipment is different. Even within the 777 family, the 300ER has a different cabin configuration from the 200. The purser assigns emergency roles. Who's responsible for which door? Who handles the evacuation slide? Who's in charge of the medical kit? And then they review the passenger manifest.
The manifest being more than just a list of names.
It flags unaccompanied minors, passengers with medical conditions, passengers requiring special assistance, and any VIPs or dignitaries. The crew needs to know that seat 23A has a severe nut allergy, or that seat 47C is an unaccompanied 9-year-old, or that there's a diplomat in business class who cannot be seated next to a national of a particular country. These are real considerations that the purser has to absorb and brief to the team.
We've covered the strategic phase and the tactical phase. Now we're at the gate. The aircraft has just arrived from its previous flight, and we've got about 90 minutes to turn it around.
This is where we meet the turnaround coordinator. This person is essentially the conductor of a very loud, very fast orchestra. They're standing on the ramp with a tablet, usually running software like Citta or AeroCloud, and they're tracking every service in real time. Catering truck, lavatory service, fuel bowser, potable water, baggage loading, cargo loading, cleaning team. Each of these is a separate contractor or department, and they all have to hit their marks in sequence.
They can't all approach the aircraft at the same time.
No, there's a choreography. The fuel bowser can't be on the right side while the catering truck is on the left because the aircraft has weight and balance constraints. The lavatory truck needs to finish before the catering truck positions because they use the same access point. The baggage loaders need the forward hold loaded before the aft hold because the load sheet is being calculated in real time.
Let's talk about the load sheet because that's the document that ties everything together.
The load sheet is the single most important piece of paper in the turnaround. It tells the captain the exact weight of the aircraft, the distribution of that weight, and the center of gravity. The dispatcher calculates it based on the passenger count, the baggage weight, the cargo weight, and the fuel load. And here's the thing that most people don't realize. The baggage team has to reconcile the load sheet with the passenger count. If there's a mismatch, if there are 212 passengers but 215 checked bags, the flight doesn't move until that's resolved.
Because a bag without a passenger is a security risk.
It's called a positive passenger bag match. It's been standard since the late 1980s after the Lockerbie bombing. Every bag on the aircraft must be matched to a passenger who was boarded. If a passenger checks a bag and doesn't board, that bag comes off. And finding one bag in a hold full of 300 bags is not a quick process. This is one of the most common causes of delays that passengers never hear about.
Meanwhile, the catering truck is loading 300 to 400 meals in about 45 minutes.
Each meal is tracked by a catering manifest that accounts for special meals. Kosher, halal, vegan, gluten-free, diabetic, child meals, religious meals, medical meals. A 777 might have 40 different special meal codes. The catering team has to verify that the right meal is in the right galley position for the right seat, and they're doing this in a truck that's elevated to door height in all weather with the clock running.
The cleaning team has about 20 minutes to reset the entire cabin.
20 minutes for a 777. That's roughly 300 seats, 8 lavatories, 4 galleys. They're collecting trash, vacuuming, restocking lavatory supplies, wiping down surfaces, crossing seat belts, resetting entertainment screens. And they're doing this while the cabin crew is doing their own pre-flight checks, so they're working around each other in a narrow tube.
It's like a Formula One pit stop, except the car is a 200-ton aircraft, and the pit crew is 50 people from 6 different companies.
The consequences of getting it wrong aren't losing a race. They're regulatory violations. Let's talk about what happens in the final 30 minutes. The gate agent scans boarding passes, and every scan triggers what's called a go message to the ramp. The ramp team now knows exactly who has boarded and who hasn't. The captain requests pushback clearance from Heathrow Ground. The dispatcher sends the final load sheet via ACARS, which is the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, basically a text message system for aircraft.
The cockpit goes sterile.
Sterile cockpit procedure kicks in. From pushback to 10,000 feet, and again from 10,000 feet to the gate on arrival, the flight deck is a no-interruption zone, no conversation that isn't directly related to the operation of the aircraft. The cabin crew won't call the flight deck unless it's an emergency. The pilots are fully focused on checklists, clearances, and configuration.
Let's walk through what happens when something goes wrong, because that's where the system reveals itself. You mentioned a case study, the British Airways IT outage.
May 27, 2023. BA's entire IT system went down at Heathrow. Flights were grounded for hours. And the root cause, when investigators dug into it, was a single failed load sheet transmission. One digital handoff between the dispatch system and the aircraft didn't complete, and because the system was designed with dependencies, that failure cascaded. The load sheet couldn't be verified, so the flight couldn't push back. The aircraft sitting at the gate blocked other aircraft from using that gate. The blocked aircraft missed their slots. The missed slots meant they had to refile their flight plans with new departure times, which overloaded the dispatch system, which caused more load sheet delays.
A single failed handoff. That's the thing about complex systems. They don't fail because someone was lazy. They fail because the dependencies are so tightly coupled that one small break propagates in ways no one predicted.
This is why the dispatcher and the turnaround coordinator have such high-stress jobs. They're not just following a checklist, they're constantly scanning for the thing that's about to break. A catering truck is stuck in traffic. That's a 5-minute delay. But that 5 minutes might mean the aircraft misses its slot, which means a 30-minute hold, which means the crew runs up against their duty time limit, which means the flight cancels. The coordinator is playing three-dimensional chess with consequences.
This is where the operating model of the airline really matters. A low-cost, long-haul carrier like Norse Atlantic does this with fewer staff and tighter margins.
They use what's called a lean turnaround model. Fewer catering options, which means a simpler catering manifest. Faster cleaning because there's less premium cabin complexity. Fewer special meal codes to manage. And they typically use newer, more standardized aircraft, which means the crew briefing is simpler because everyone's flying the same type. The trade-off is resilience. When everything goes right, a lean turnaround is faster and cheaper. When something goes wrong, there's less slack in the system to absorb the shock.
Which is why the legacy carriers, like BA, maintain larger ground teams even though it costs more. The slack is the point.
The slack is insurance. That extra ramp agent, the redundant catering check, the longer crew briefing. None of that is waste. It's buffer against the unpredictable.
All right, so let's zoom out and talk about what makes this an ordinary miracle. The phrase is good because it captures the paradox. It's miraculous in its complexity and ordinary in its reliability. At exactly 11 a.m., or within the 15-minute window that counts as on time, BA-17-8 pushes back. The passengers are settling into their seats, finding their movies, ordering their first drink. And not one of them has seen a single person who made it happen.
The dispatcher who stayed up late running fuel calculations. The fleet assignment analyst who solved the crew pairing puzzle 3 days ago. The caterer who loaded the kosher meal into galley position 3 left. The ramp agent who spotted a loose seal on the forward cargo door and flagged it for maintenance. The cleaning team lead who found a lost passport under C-22B and got it back to the gate agent before the passenger even realized it was missing.
All of those stories evaporate the moment the aircraft leaves the gate. The system is designed to be invisible, and that's actually the highest compliment you can pay it. When the system works, you don't know it exists.
When it fails, everyone blames the airline, which is understandable but also unfair to the thousands of people who got it right that day for the one thing that went wrong. Most delays that get announced as operational reasons are not one thing. They're a chain. The inbound aircraft was late because of weather in Frankfurt. That cascaded into a late cleaning start. The late cleaning cascaded into a delayed catering load. The delayed catering load meant the load sheet wasn't finalized in time for the slot. The missed slot meant a 30-minute hold for a new departure time. None of those things is anyone's fault individually. It's just the nature of a tightly coupled system.
Here's a practical takeaway for anyone who flies. Next time you're at the gate, look out the window at the ramp. Count the number of vehicles that approach the aircraft. You'll see the fuel bowser, the catering truck, the baggage loaders, the lavatory truck, the potable water truck, the cargo loader, the pushback tug. Each one of those vehicles represents a department that coordinated with the turnaround coordinator days in advance.
If you can get a look at the load sheet, which you sometimes can if you're sitting near the gate agent's desk, or if you ask nicely and the agent is feeling generous, look at it. It's a single page that has the aircraft weight, the center of gravity, the fuel distribution, the passenger count by zone, the baggage count, the cargo count. Every department that touched that aircraft is represented on that one sheet of paper.
The load sheet is the Rosetta Stone of the turnaround.
It really is. And once you understand what it represents, you never look at a departure the same way again.
Let's talk about where this is all going. The episode plan you sketched out mentioned something about AI and automation creeping into dispatch and crew scheduling.
This is the big open question. Airlines are investing heavily in what's called predictive turnaround. Machine learning models that ingest data from hundreds of previous turnarounds and try to forecast delays before they happen. The idea is that if the system can predict that the catering truck is going to be 5 minutes late, it can proactively adjust the slot, or resequence the boarding process, or hold the pushback tug in position, rather than reacting after the delay has already cascaded.
The promise is fewer delays, more efficient operations, lower costs. The risk is that you automate away the human judgment that currently catches the things the model doesn't see.
That's exactly the tension. A machine learning model can tell you that historically, catering trucks are late 15% of the time when it's raining at Heathrow. It cannot tell you that the specific catering driver today, Maria, who's been doing this route for 12 years, noticed that the galley seal on the forward left position looked worn and flagged it for maintenance inspection. That kind of human observation, the ramp agent who spots a loose seal, the dispatcher who has a gut feeling about a weather system, the captain who decides to tanker an extra ton of fuel because something about the forecast doesn't sit right, that's not in the data.
The industry has a mixed record on this. Automation has made aviation dramatically safer over the last 40 years. But it's also introduced new failure modes, like the loss of manual flying skills that showed up in the Air France, 447 crash, and the Boeing 737 MAX issues.
The MAX is the cautionary tale here. Automation that was designed to make the aircraft safer ended up making it less safe because the human pilots didn't fully understand what the automation was doing in edge cases. If we apply the same logic to ground operations, the risk is that predictive turnaround systems optimize for the 95% of cases and create brittle failure modes for the 5% that the model hasn't seen.
Which is why the dispatcher and the turnaround coordinator aren't going anywhere. The tools will get better, but the human judgment that sits on top of them is the insurance policy.
I think that's the deeper point. The ordinary miracle of a transatlantic flight isn't just the technology. It's the human system that's been built up over decades to manage the technology safely. 200 people, most of whom will never be thanked, doing their jobs so well that their work becomes invisible.
Next time you're watching one of those behind-the-scenes YouTube videos of a crew briefing, you'll know that what you're seeing is the tip of an iceberg. Below the waterline are 3 days of planning, dozens of people, and a regulatory framework that's been battle-tested over millions of flights.
The crew briefing itself, that huddle you see in the video, is where all of that planning gets distilled into a shared mental model. The captain and the first officer and the purser and the cabin crew are all getting on the same page about what could go wrong and who does what if it does. It's not a formality. It's the final safety net.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Inuktitut word, Kwangatasu Karvik, means airport, but its literal morphological breakdown, as documented by linguists studying polysynthetic structure in the 1970s, is place for the activity of raising up repeatedly. Meanwhile, in Guyana, the Wapishana language uses a single polysynthetic verb, katabaradan, to mean he will cause it to fly across, a construction that encodes agent, patient, causation, motion, and direction in one word. Neither language has a native word for delay.
Right.
That was unsettlingly on topic for a fun fact that's supposed to be random.
The system is breaking down. Here's the thought I want to leave you with. The next time you fly, whether it's across the Atlantic or just to the next city, take 30 seconds towards the ramp. You'll see a dozen people doing a dozen different jobs, and every single one of them is part of a system that took decades to build and takes 200 people to execute. It's the closest thing we have to a daily miracle, and it works so well that we've forgotten how extraordinary it is.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the inscrutable Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to dig deeper into the invisible systems that make aviation work, we've covered overflight fees, boarding pass handshakes, and the regulatory patchwork behind those Hebrew announcements on flights to Tel Aviv. None of which I'm supposed to tell you to go listen to, but the episodes exist, and so do you.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.